Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We're wrapping up 2012 this hour with a big look back on the year. From the campaign trail to the fiscal cliff to Hurricane Sandy, from Aurora to Newtown, Benghazi to Damascus. It's our year in the news wrap-up as 2012 barrels toward the new year 2013. In presidential politics, Republicans thought they smelled victory. Wrong. President Barack Obama was decisively reelected. Here he was on election night.
With your stories and your struggles, I return to the White House more determined and more inspired than ever about the work there is to do and the future that lies ahead.
In Syria, war and a terrible toll, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon summed up the emotion and the numbers.
I'm shocked and saddened and even angry at this human tragedy. After 21 months, more than 40,000 people have been killed.
At year's end, tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut. 6 and 7-year-olds, teachers mowed down at school. Krista Rakos lost her 6-year-old daughter, Jessica.
Still not real, but my little girl who's so full of life and who wants a horse so badly and who's gonna get cowgirl boots for Christmas isn't coming home.
And even now, the fiscal cliffhanger goes on. Yesterday, House Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer said the American people just want Congress to deal with it.
They don't really care about our politics internally in the House of Representatives. What they care about is the failure to act so that they will be protected from tax increases and from other adverse consequences.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable takes on the year 2012 with Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, John Harwood of CNBC, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Karen Tumulty joins us today from Chevy Chase, Maryland, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, in the thick of it right now and all year long on the campaign trail and beyond. Karen Tumulty, you're the best. Thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Happy New Year.
Same to you. Happy New Year. From Silver Spring, Maryland, John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, political writer for the New York Times, our Bigfoot wise eye superstar, John Harwood. We are happy to have you with us wrapping up the year.
Hi, Tom. It's great to do your show in sweatpants.
We'll picture that. We'll think about that for an hour, John. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, the one and only our sublime arbiter of actuality, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Karen, and John.
All right, here we are. We've got a big year to look at, but it's one of those years where even in this year, which is supposed to be just cookies and oblivion, we've got all kinds of politics going on the fiscal cliff. We'll go bigger, but let's figure out where we are right here, right now. Here was the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, talking about his fiscal cliff frustrations. This is just yesterday on the Senate floor, going so far as to accuse the House of Representatives of being a dictatorship under Republican Speaker John Boehner.
The American people, I don't think, understand the House of Representatives is operating without the House of Representatives. It's being operated with a dictatorship of the Speaker, not allowing the vast majority of the House of Representatives to get what they want. On any given day for the last 5 or 6 months, since July 25th, Speaker Boehner could have brought the Senate-passed middle-class tax cut legislation to a vote in the House, and it would pass. But he has made the decision that he's not going to let a vote on that, because if he let it be voted upon, it would pass.
Well, so says Harry Reid yesterday. He looked kind of lonely there, a lot of grumpy senators back in town. Meeting at the White House today of the congressional leadership with the president. House coming back on Sunday night. Karen, is there a snowball's chance in anywhere of something coming out of this that forestalls the over the cliff we go?
Well, it's looking less and less likely, and while I'm sorry to differ with Harry Reid here, I think John Boehner has proven in the past couple of weeks that he is anything but a dictator, given that he had attempted to put his own plan on the floor and got, you know, smacked down by his own caucus. So I think that, you know, at this point, it seems like the closer we get to the edge of this cliff, the less incentive either side is getting now to move. And, you know, increasingly it looks as though a lot of Republican and Democratic members would just as soon go over it, because then for the Republicans, after the beginning of the year, if all these Bush tax cuts expire, they can actually come to some kind of deal that actually does look like a tax cut for most people.
So maybe on the other side, I mean, it's getting to where I can barely stand to hear the words fiscal cliff, but here we are dancing on it. Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor yesterday said Republicans willing to work across the aisle to avoid that cliff, but they simply won't write a blank check.
Republicans aren't about to write a blank check for anything Senate Democrats put forward just because we find ourselves at the edge of the cliff. That having been said, we'll see what the president has to propose. Members on both sides of the aisle will review it, and then we'll decide how best to proceed. Hopefully, there's still time for an agreement of some kind that saves the taxpayers from a wholly, wholly preventable economic crisis.
John Harwood, something of some kind in these last few days, or over we go and we'll deal on the other side?
I think, Tom, we do have a snowball's chance, not much more than a snowball. And you heard both sides of Mitch McConnell in that little quip that you just played. On the one hand, he's trying to be a good soldier as leader of the Republicans in the Senate. He's trying not to undercut Speaker Boehner in the House. He's trying to avoid the wrath of the Tea Party, which might challenge him in a Senate primary in Kentucky next year. But he also is somebody who, at the end of the day, wants to solve problems or at least alleviate a nagging headache for the Republican Party, which is the idea that they are standing in the way of some sort of resolution. In the summer of 2011, he did it on the debt limit by coming up with an agreement that allowed Republicans to pretend they weren't actually embracing an extended raising of the debt limit, and but nevertheless did so. And I think what he's trying to figure out now is there a way that he can godfather a deal that avoids blame from the right, but also avoids some of the challenges that Republicans face from the mass of public opinion in the country.
Jack Beatty, let's hear from John Boehner himself. And this was not in this week's or even last week's thick of the fiscal cliff talks, but this was the day after the November elections. This was the Republican Speaker of the House giving his thoughts on the American people voting in a divided government and its meaning.
The American people have spoken. They've reelected President Obama, and they've again reelected a Republican majority in the House of Representatives. If there's a mandate in yesterday's results, it's a mandate for us to find a way to work together on the solutions to the challenges that we all face as a nation.
Whoops. Jack, where did that go?
Yeah, that bumped up against reality. And reality in this case is the prior commitments of many, if not all, House members to no taxes, no new taxes under any circumstances. And I think looking at the prospects before the fiscal cliff, they saw they would have to sign on to a tax increase. That would violate their various pledges. That might well trigger primary challenges for some. And as we've heard again and again on this program, politicians will not, for any reason, commit political suicide. According to one poll recently, 70% of voters in Republican districts call themselves conservative or very conservative. Only 40% of Democrats in Democratic districts call themselves liberal or very liberal. It's extremely difficult under those conditions for Republicans to compromise on taxes. If they go over the cliff, taxes will they'll essentially not have to vote for any new tax increases. That will just happen automatically, and they'll be able to vote for a tax cut for 98% of the people. So I think that seems to be the argument prevailing among Republican backbenchers.
But here's the thing, Karen. I mean, you quote a Republican strategist recently saying the only thing that will get Washington to strike a deal is a stock market crash. I mean, looking back on this whole year and the politics we've seen and their resolution and lack of resolution, can a major country and a giant economy go on in this way, a kind of polarization paralysis waiting for stock market crashes to bring about action?
You know, it is a pretty horrifying turn of events. We keep every year we think Washington is as bad as it could get, and then the next year comes along and we see it even worse. But, you know, it does seem like the only way in which these guys can act is an actual crisis. And don't forget that this is a crisis that they themselves manufactured,
sure,
recognizing this.
I mean, John, is that where we've come, the period of crisis-driven government? That's the only thing that will do it?
Yes. The only dictatorship in Washington is the dysfunction of the two-party system as it plays out in the Congress and the inability of Congress to act. We saw that even, think back to 2008, the fall of 2008, when we were facing a Wall Street collapse. You even had a vote go down from what a Republican president, Republican Treasury Secretary said was needed rescue program, that was TARP, and it ultimately was resurrected, but there are a lot of members who paid a big political price for that. That was even more of a crisis, much more of a crisis than this situation. So it does take extreme incentives to alter the partisan dynamics.
John, hold the thought. It's a man-made cliff, but we're on the edge right now. Call me maybe. Who's going to call whom here? Listeners, we're looking back on a week, a year in the news, 2012. Fiscal cliff, superstorms, big politics, mass shootings, and somehow the world did not end. Carly Rae Jepsen nominated for Song of the Year. Call me maybe. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week, a year in the news. 2012, just about wrapped up now. Karen, John, Jack, let's hear from our listeners. Steve in Stowe, Vermont. Plenty of snow up there right now, I hear. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Listen, you asked the question, what did you learn during 2012? Mm-hmm. And what I learned is this country is so diametrically opposed, so polarized. We have two factions, and we don't disagree just on one or two issues like tax policy or abortion. We disagree on everything, and it's because this country has become so ungovernable. I almost think that inevitably we'll have to create two countries, because the population on the right and the left just can't see eye to eye on anything. There's no compromise. It's impossible to govern this country anymore, and we're becoming the laughing stock of the world.
Steve, you've got a great big view there. Let me hold that. We're so, so polarized. We need two countries here. I'll take that to my panel. Let me get a couple of more, Steve, but there's a big thought and a bad one, I hope, but I understand how you see it that way. Andy, who's on I-55 in Illinois. Andy, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yeah, I think it's not what was covered in the news, but what was not covered in the news. The Arctic ice sheet in the north shrunk to its lowest level ever. It went into exponential meltdown. Greenland was 90% of the ice sheet in Greenland was melting.
Yep.
We had a drought so severe that hasn't broken yet. The Mississippi River is so low they may have to suspend barge traffic, and it gets a little teeny blip on the news once in a while. I mean, the World Bank says we are on forecast for 4 degrees Celsius by the middle of the century.
Temperature.
And the World Bank's not exactly a left-leaning organization.
No, not exactly. And that means temperature rise, and that means rough implications. We saw more attention around Hurricane Sandy time, but we have seen all year long this wild weather and the kind of consequences you're talking about. Andy, thanks for that. One more. Robert in Burlington, Vermont. Robert, you're on.
Well, this is the other anthropogenic problem, and it was the one with guns. We had Oregon, and we had Wisconsin,
yep,
happen, and we had began with Aurora this year, and then the thing that stunk the most was happened in Newtown, Connecticut, mm-hmm, and then that had a postscript with multiple cop killings, including firefighters being killed.
Yeah.
And the NRA, they continue to blame this on violent video games, anything else than guns. And then they come back and they tell us that this is just not a problem that cannot be solved with more guns. Their solution to the problem is more guns. I think we're going to find out that 2012 is a tipping year.
All right, Robert, I appreciate your call as well. Karen, John, Jack, our listeners set the table. big and rich there. Let's go right back, if we could, to where Steve starts us out. We are so divided on so many fronts. Two factions disagree on everything. We need two countries. Karen, how does this resolve?
I don't really think the country itself is that polarized, but what has become polarized is the way we elect our representatives in Congress. And Nate Silver of the New York Times has an interesting piece today where he looks back and he points out that, if 20 years ago, nearly a quarter of all the seats in the House of Representatives were in swing districts, mm-hmm. which meant that by definition, to get elected in those districts, you would have to get both Democrats and Republicans to vote for you. Now, the lines have been so differently drawn that it's something like three dozen districts as opposed to over 100 are places where you actually have to get things done, opposed to the districts that are very liberal or very conservative, where all you really have to do is worry about a challenger in the primary, and if you can get through your primary, you're golden. So I think that the way that we have set up our political system has in many ways elected people who don't necessarily represent public sentiment, because I think if you were to look at most of the country, people can come up with some kind of agreement. It's very clear that public sentiment is very much in favor right now of raising taxes on upper income earners, and yet the U.S. Congress cannot bring itself to do that.
So, John Harwood, how does this get resolved? I sat down in October with Grover Norquist. He pulled out a map that showed how all the districts had been redrawn in redistricting, looked at that and said with absolute confidence, this is red, it's going to stay red, we've got a red majority here, and it's growing from the local elections up. And yet, as our caller says, you've got this very divided opinion, and even beyond that, maybe a desire to find common ground. How do we resolve this?
Well, in the long run, in terms of the ideological challenge that Karen was just describing, it may require more pain absorbed by the Republican Party because, as she said, the position of Democrats and the president in this fight is much more popular in the country than the position that Republicans are articulating. And, in fact, Republicans sort of instinctually know that because while they're calling for the president to enact or propose more spending cuts to entitlement programs, they're not really proposing those themselves because the Medicare and Social Security programs, which we're talking about, are extremely popular programs.
Mm-hmm.
But the Republicans suffered a lot of pain from losing this past election. They thought they were going to win. Yes, they won the House, but they lost ground in the House. They also lost ground in the Senate. The more beatings the Republican Party takes to its reputation and to its electoral fortunes, the more it is likely to adapt to the contours of public opinion.
Two countries in one, our caller says, Jack. How does a single country resolve that kind of dynamic?
Yes, and it's not, strictly speaking, north-south or anything, sort of gross like that. It's country-city. I mean, the red districts begin in about Reading, Pennsylvania, and go all the way out to the suburbs of San Francisco. Writing on Christmas Day in the Washington Post, Norm Ornstein says, America's political dysfunction is driven by a Republican Party that has become an insurgent outlier. This is the analysis that he and Tom Mann have put out in their book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks. And they say that what happened in 2010 was really something, if not unique, then unusual. That is, the Republican Party, that was a historic election. It returned a majority that is simply opposed to the normal way government works, which is in a separation of powers system compromise. Someone from the opposition party has to go over and work with the other side. That's typically how it's gone. But the people who ran in 2010, or many of them, ran on no compromise on taxes, but really on almost anything else. And the result is that you have politics is now our major problem. I mean, we don't have an economic problem really. We have a slow economy, but partly it's slow because of politics. No second stimulus bill, no an effort to really, by the Republicans, to prevent the president from stimulating the economy. And, of course, you say, well, this is all the Republicans' fault. Well, but it's again, that suicide, that you can't say to a representative, go out and risk your career to help somebody in the opposition party. It is, you know, Ornstein says more and more people want to simply serve their party above their country, but really it isn't even their party, it's their career. And I don't think John sees a softening, perhaps, but I don't think anything changes until the next census, 2020, when these districts could then be possibly, if the Iowa model spreads, put together by commissions and made more bipartisan, and you'd have more competitive elections. But that doesn't.
But that's a long old time and a big maybe. Even when you get there, I mean, Karen, Norm Ornstein may see an insurgency here, but Republicans I talk to don't see themselves as insurgents. They see themselves as loyalists to a vision, kind of almost Alamo last standers sometimes since the November election. What about the conversation inside the GOP and what you hear there about their way forward, Karen?
Well, I think you're beginning to hear a conversation very much like the one that happened with the Democrats in the late 1980s. After losing back-to-back presidential elections, they actually had to begin to look at some of their policies. You know, they had gone through all the stages of denial. You know, oh, if only we had a charismatic presidential candidate like that Ronald Reagan. Well, then they got beaten by George Herbert Walker Bush. And at some point, they began to believe that, you know, maybe the problem here was actually their policies. And there is a really interesting paper that was written by Elaine K. Mark at the Kennedy School and Bill Galston now at Brookings, called The Politics of Evasion, about the fact that, you know, the problems that the Democrats were having. Believe it or not, at that point they were worried because they were losing all the young people to the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go back and read that paper, and I would highly recommend it. It's easy to Google. Elaine K. Mark, Bill Galston, The Politics of Evasion. And just about everything they said about the Democrats at that point in time, you could put the word Republicans in there and sort of see where that party stands.
Evasion. I don't know if that's how people see it. John Harwood, I want to ask you about the big Republican this year who did not win, Mitt Romney. Here was maybe the moment in the year captured on a little bootleg video where he talked about 47% of Americans might have made the difference in that election, the famous 47%.
There are 47% of the people who vote for the president no matter what. All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they're entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. But that's an entitlement, and the government should give it to them. And they will vote for this president no matter what.
Talk about a viral video. John Harwood, look back on the Mitt Romney, and we had so much presidential politics in the last 2 years. They finally came to a head in November. Barack Obama took it. He took back the White House. What's the last word on Mitt Romney's challenge to this sitting president, John?
Well, first of all, what Karen was just talking about with the Democrats in 1968 to 1988, during that period where they lost most of the presidential elections, that's the sort of pain that I was talking about, causing political parties to reconsider. And secondly, the 47% video that you just played, the audio portion of it, that is why they are losing. That is a loser's message for Republicans because, first of all, it is insulting to a large number of people, but second of all, it's fundamentally false because so many of the people that Mitt Romney was deriding as the takers and the moochers and that sort of thing were senior citizens on Social Security and Medicare who were the strongest supporters of his own campaign. The Republican Party, what it needs to do is adapt to the reality of a changing America and the reality of a level of government that people in the United States want that Republicans have been opposed to or thinking that they were opposed to. And until they recognize that, given the fact that it is a party dominantly composed of white conservatives and that they are a declining force in our politics, they're not going to win elections. They've lost the popular vote in 5 out of 6 presidential elections. That's not a formula for success, and they're going to have to change. And Karen's right. That conversation is already beginning.
Interesting, though. Not the lesson that a lot of people, Republicans, expected to get out of 2012. We've still got climate and guns on the table from our callers, but let's go right here. Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. I wanted to kind of offer an opposing view of an earlier caller that talked about separating America into two countries.
Mm. Yes, please. Please do.
It just feels like... Yeah, pardon?
Please do.
Yes. Okay. So I guess I am a glass half full person. I feel like this is the greatest country in the world, and it didn't come easily, and it's not going to come easily now. And if we don't stand sort of together, even if it's painful, then we're going to fall together. And it's just part of, in history, it's always been painful. It's been bloody. It's been difficult to sort of bring people together. And the mandate of Obama being reelected is that the majority of the people want this country to move forward with some of what we need to take, which is, you know, what Republicans would call entitlements. We need to take care of people. It's part of being kind. And I think with the shooting in Newtown, it has kind of made people step back and go, well, maybe we're not as kind to each other as we need to be. And that just would be my message for the new year. Is to take a minute to find out your so-called opponent's views. We probably have a lot more in common than we don't.
People take
the time to do that.
Take care of one another. Be kind. It's funny, even that, Karen, take care of one another became kind of a divisive political mantra during the campaign, because that taking care of one another got branded sort of socialism or something along the way, Karen.
Yeah, that being, of course, one of the most overused words in the
2012
election this year.
Yeah.
I do think, you know, with the basic debate over the size and scope of government and what its responsibilities is one that will continue, because, you know, we're also looking at a big problem. The Republicans are looking at a big demographic problem. With the fact that this is becoming a more diverse country, the Democrats are looking at a big demographic problem with the fact that the entitlement system is really not sustainable with as many, with an aging kind of population as we have. So I do think that debate is going to continue with that as the framework.
That is a giant, giant piece that has yet to be addressed. We thought it might be addressed in this season, Jack. We thought it might be addressed in at least some beginning on that in these fiscal cliff talks.
Well, that was the hope. The big bargain, Democrats agreeing to do something on entitlements, Republicans agreeing to increase taxes on the top 2%. That hasn't happened. Maybe it'll happen once we're over the cliff, however, in whatever condition we wind up in. But the president did make some movement there, the movement on Social Security, on changing the formula there.
We'll look on the other side of a little break here, Gangnam Style. Listen, we've got our debates in this country with the world moves. Big hit this year out of South Korea by pop star Psy, Gangnam Style. Everybody whoopee-tie-yay-ing. We're looking at a week, a year in the news, 2012. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this year, 17-year-old unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin shot and killed in February 26th, by volunteer neighborhood watchman George Zimmerman. Here's Zimmerman giving chase to Trayvon Martin on the phone with a 911 dispatcher.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
Okay.
Okay, he said, but he did follow him. 16-year-old American gymnast Gabby Douglas wowed the world at the summer's London Olympics, winning gold in the team and individual all-around competitions. The crowd loved her.
And it's a Gabby gold!
I was like, yes, all the hard work's paid off. And, I was speechless. And I was like, tears of joy and just waving to the crowd.
With a whole lot of Gabby gold. And on August 6th, after traveling more than 8 months and 352 million miles, NASA's Curiosity rover landed safely on Mars. Ground control went nuts.
Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars.
A great moment. In a tough year, we're looking at a year in the news, 2012, fiscal cliff, superstorms, big politics, mass shootings, and yet somehow the world did not end with the Mayan calendar. Karen Tumblety of the Washington Post is here. John Harwood of CNBC and the New York Times, our own Jack Beatty, Bruce in Essex, Vermont. Bruce, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My somewhat rhetorical question is, do you think that this ever going to be recognition of the fact that the two parties are in complete agreement on adding $8 trillion to the national debt over the next 10 years?
I mean, how do we ultimately get a grip on that? It's still out there and it's mounting, and a lot of people are looking at that. I mean, John,
I haven't heard a single person on your show, and I listen every day, or anybody else taking note of what I just said.
Well, I beg to differ. People have certainly talked about that, but how we fix that still sits out there. And, John, you have people saying, well, yes, over time, we'll save a trillion over 10 years or a trillion and a half. But here's Bruce and says, well, it's mounting much faster than that. You know, people talk about spending now to get the economy going, and that will fix it. But is there any kind of real navigation toward a solution to that crunch out there, John?
I think so. I mean, that's why we have the fiscal cliff. It's because there has been an effort that hasn't gotten nearly as far as it might have, but there is an effort by both parties to achieve some sort of long-term stabilization of our debt and deficit position because of the very problem that Karen talked about a moment ago, the looming retirement of the baby boomers, which is going to make us insolvent. So everybody's trying to get $4 trillion of over 10 years of deficit reduction. The question is, what are the contours? At the end of the day, we're going to get it. It's just a matter of when and how much pain we have to suffer before we get there.
Do you feel that consensus, Karen, that we will get this savings, these cuts, one way or another? I mean, John says the fiscal cliff is a sign, you know, we set that up as a go to do it, but it's not clear we're going to really respond to even this. We're just going over the cliff.
You know, I don't know how or if we get there, but if you might recall, the real thing that kind of saved the budget in the late 1990s was economic growth, and specifically the technology boom. So there may be some sort of outside event that can do something that you know, Congress and the president seem incapable of doing. But I do think that having to manufacture these crises like the one that we're in right now is exactly the worst way to go about government.
And yet here we are right in the middle of that. Wendell in Louisville, Kentucky. Wendell, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. It's my first time calling.
Great.
I believe President Obama, when he said that he's willing to pay more taxes to start with himself personally, because he makes over $250,000, that I believe he would say to the GOP and congressmen, I'm willing to forego my salary, and I'm asking all congressmen to forego their salary until we do the job of the American people. And as keep the physical cliff from happening.
You know,
any other paid employees that don't do their job right should not be getting paid.
Put their own pay stubs on the line. I mean, Jack, what Wendell says, you know, have them not just care about their reelection, but about their actual week-to-week pay. It's a little late for this year. They got most of that in the can already. I don't know where that leverage comes from, Jack.
No, and of course, symbolically that would say something, but fiscally it would be a trivial amount. And you know, when you think it through, it would make Congress even safer for millionaires. I mean, as it is, the Senate is populated by overwhelmingly by people of great means, and this would giving up salary would make it even tougher for ordinary people to stay in office. Although I think Wendell's intuition there is in some basic way right. You know, a couple of years ago, political scientist John McCormick wrote a piece really talking about going back to the ancients and to Machiavelli and to saying, you know, the split between rulers and ruled has haunted polities over the aeons. And one way to deal with it is to make the rulers live like the ruled. And he
he sort of drolly, but not wholly pointlessly, drew out a thought experiment. Imagine if you had the people living in dormitories, if you had them living on the minimum wage, if you had them eating food stamps, and so on. No one doubts that if that were the case, we would have a different government. And it isn't a trivial thing to think about the gap between the average, sort of the worldview of the average person in Congress and that of the average citizen.
Well, let's look at one piece of it that we are sort of all in together, though I'm sure some are more insulated than others. But we have had such a drumbeat of extreme weather in this year that it has opened a lot of people's eyes and minds to thinking again, maybe more seriously, about climate change. I mean, it was just hard to watch the suffering in Hurricane Sandy superstorm there. Here's just a little bit of tape. This was Donna Soli. You may have seen this. Staten Island, desperation in her voice days after the hurricane destroyed her home and her community.
We have no cars. Don't you see? We need the, please, President Obama, please listen to us down here. We are going to die. You don't understand. You've got to get your trucks here on this corner now.
On the shore, as Superstorm Sandy came ashore, Karen Tumulty in that big whack to this biggest city in America, New York, and far beyond, do you see in that and drought and the wildfires and all the rest, do you see some shift in the way Washington is looking at climate and what ought to be or not be done about it?
The short answer is no, at least not now. I think that it was very little talked about during the campaign in terms of concrete things that could be done. And now when you hear the White House and the president talk about what he intends to do on this in a second term, he's talking more in terms of sort of mounting an educational effort, you know, going around the country and speaking out and pointing out to people that, that these climate events are not just sort of random things, that there is something going on out there that is man-made that is contributing to it. But in terms of actually putting forward legislation that would really take a big whack at this, you're hearing people talk less and less about that. And just yesterday, we learned about the resignation of the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Lisa Jackson.
Yes.
I think that her disappointment over actual progress under this Democratic administration is very well known.
John Harwood, where do you see this? I mean, nationally, but also, I guess, globally, because it's a global challenge. You know, what people take away from weather events we see on the ground, how and whether that is really moving the dial on readiness to respond to apparent climate change.
First of all, Tom, I would say I have learned something from doing this show today, which is that I Googled the word anthropogenic after our caller.
It's all about humans, baby.
A few moments ago. Look, I think that climate change, there is growing awareness of it. There, over the long run, something is going to happen, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. The economic anxiety that Americans feel and the sort of tenuous state that we're struggling with right now in this fiscal cliff fight makes it very, very difficult to propose any full-on approach to climate change. I think the president's going to try to figure out an alternative route in the second term. He did some things in the first term, like auto efficiency standards and regulations for power plants. But the things that people who are serious about this issue, like carbon tax or cap and trade, I think they're not happening anytime soon.
Jack, if it's not Hurricane Sandy, you know, taking on our biggest city and really swamping it there, and the year of drought and the Mississippi, as our caller said, where barges can barely make it go, and the wildfires, I mean, what does it take, Jack, to turn heads and get people really focused here?
Well, I've often thought it would take, you know, Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard disappearing, but
I don't think that'll do it, Jack. Sorry.
Short of that, you know, tragically, and I think it is tragic because for the whole future of humanity, our poison politics is really threatening, I think, the planet. The Republican Party in its majority simply either denies global warming or if it admits it, says, well, we're not sure, as Mitt Romney says, what's causing it. Well, here we have the St. Louis Post-Dispatch saying
today that pointing out that 13,000 peer-reviewed studies of climate change since 1991, only 24 have rejected the global warming hypothesis, 24 studies out of 14,000. And yet one party says we're not sure at best, and it isn't happening at worst. That's just a dreadful situation for the future.
We've got climate, we've got politics, we've got guns to look at. Janine's calling from Iowa City. Janine, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
One of my big concerns is the fact that there's been very little talk in these fiscal cliff discussions about the fact that investment income is actually taxed at a much lower rate than, you know, I suppose what I would call working salaries. And we also have lots, I mean, billions of dollars going to oil companies that also has not really been very openly discussed. And even in, you know, the farm bill, we have issues with million-dollar farmers, corporate farmers that are getting, you know, enough money basically to pay Social Security for tons of people. And, you know, my question is, why are some of these things off the table, especially when you have a lot of private equity firms buying up even sometimes viable companies, being able to deduct the interest that they have sacked these companies with?
Yeah, Janine, we've got it. I mean, Karen, thank you, Janine. People are dialing in here, Karen. But can we scrape away all the tax breaks and fix the problem?
Well, you know, there was some talk that some sort of big, massive tax reform could possibly be in the works, maybe even beginning with these fiscal cliff negotiations. But we just don't see that happening. But you know, the Tax Reform Act of 1986 did, in fact, get rid of the preference for capital gains taxes. That meant that investment income was taxed at the same rates as sweat income. And that was reversed during the Clinton years with a Republican Congress and a Democratic president, because, you know, it was a function as much of, as anything, I think, of who's powerful when it comes to lobbying these things.
Hey, I want to look at guns, John. After Newtown, everyone was just riveted to this in the days leading up to the Christmas holiday, and even now, people still shaken by it. Then we heard the NRA come back out at the end of last week and say, hey, you want to fix this, put more guns in the schools, put armed guards in the schools. Do you see some catalyst here, John, for change on this front?
Very little. I think this is an issue that is very difficult to achieve compromise on. We saw the completely unflinching response from the National Rifle Association. Democrats have been timid on this issue, even though they would like to act for fear of the political fallout. And I think the further we get from Newtown, the lower the odds of some action on this front by Congress.
Karen, do you agree? I mean, it feels like the sorrow over that was so great, it had to mean ferment and change. No?
I'm sort of pessimistic on this as well. I mean, maybe cynical is the better word for it. I remember when I first got to Washington, one of the first gun control votes that I covered was during the 1980s, and it was the gun lobby's efforts to roll back a lot of the gun control laws that were passed in the wake of the 1968 assassinations. And police officers by the thousands descended on the Capitol for that vote, and it was very interesting because they could not bring their firearms in, so they all walked around with empty holsters. And even then, the NRA was able to, you know, get almost exactly what it wanted in that legislation.
Jack Chi Wong writes to us here online, says, every year is apocalyptic, full of crisis, political and economic distress, yet we survive and life goes on to the new year. It has felt like we've been goaded to do things this year, Jack, on a lot of fronts. Do you see status quo coming out of 2012?
I really do. I just think that the controlling factor is the 2010 election. I mean, it effectively limited the 2008 election, and I think it will control the 2012 election. That is, simply nothing that nothing can pass by way of guns, climate, the economy, through the House of Representatives unless it is, you can't have much reform that way. Now, it may be that you can have a tax reform that way. I mean, Republicans have talked that way, and they've said let's have lower rates and less loopholes. Maybe that is something that could be worked up. Maybe immigration reform, but even there. When you start to look at what Republicans are really saying, Marco Rubio, for example, they're not talking about anything very sweeping. They're not.
And there's 2012. We'll see. We felt many times this year things can't go on this way. Maybe they can. Maybe they can't. And on we go into 2013. Dave Brubeck, gone this year with his classic Take Five. Karen Tumulty with The Washington Post, thanks for looking back on this year with us. Happy New Year, Karen. Thanks for joining us.
You too, Tom.
John Harwood, CNBC, New York Times. Thank you so much, John. Best for the new year.
Happy New Year, Tom.
And to you, Jack, always. Thanks for everything this year and on to the new. On we go. Thank you very much, Jack.
Happy New Year to you and all our listeners.
Listeners, enjoy, if you can, this last weekend of 2012. On we go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.